I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi there, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and this is Women Who Travel. Today I'm talking to someone whose job can be anything from welcoming newborn black bear cubs into the world, or examining the stomach of a dead animal. Despite having numerous near-death experiences, though, she has one of the coolest jobs on the planet, researching lions in Tanzania, lemurs in Madagascar, and bears in the Sierras.
It was this like dusty brown, huge bear. And it was right, it was probably 10 feet from me, right? So it was very, 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 very close. It had silently crept up. I mean, there was no noise, you know, around me. And so one thing that struck me was like how silent it was. In the media, people see bears roar and growl. And in real life, they're very quiet. Almost always. And I didn't like pee in my pants by some miracle, but it felt like my heart absolutely stopped.
She's Dr. Ray Wynne Grant.
In Kenya and Tanzania, in Maasai land. What ended up happening over and over is that I would experience these kind of life lessons, these very personal, deep, emotional, human society lessons, kind of guided by a wild animal.
Dr. Ray is co-host of NBC's Wild Kingdom, host of the podcast Going Wild, and she's just come out with a book, Wildlife, Finding My Purpose in an Untamed World.
I'm Dr. Ray Wynne Grant, and this is a different kind of nature show, a podcast all about the human drama of saving animals. This season, we're going to take a journey through the ecological web.
You got on this path to becoming a wildlife ecologist, which sounds incredibly exciting. Can you define it?
I am a wildlife ecologist. Ecology is the study of living things and how they interact with their environment. I don't study chickens and goats and cows, but rather I study bears and lions and primates that live in the wilderness and how they interact with their environment. And the wildlife ecology that I'm most interested in is the kind that informs wildlife conservation. So figuring out, let's use lions as an example, what they need, what they use, what their patterns are, and how that can help us design better conservation programs and projects to keep them on this planet and keep them healthy and thriving.
You're almost like a wildlife detective.
Ooh.
You're trying to kind of solve the mystery of how they behave and what they're looking for.
Yeah, I think like whatever kind of scientist you are, you're essentially a detective. The goal is to uncover truth. And then if we put it in the wildlife ecology context, it's figuring out, you know, what is unknown or what is known, but let's like double test it. I didn't grow up like hiking or camping with my family or traveling to national parks. You know, even to this day, I've only been to a couple national parks. It's been for work. You know, I still don't come from a cultural group, let alone a family culture that does a lot of outdoor recreation. And I want to make sure that people know that that doesn't have to be limiting. It doesn't mean that you don't belong or that you can't start at a, you know, more advanced age or that you can't play a really big leadership role in helping the planet heal and become stronger.
It's so interesting you say that. I feel like we've been talking about this at Traveler a lot in the last few years and on this podcast as well, is that the outdoors, for something that is supposed to be for everyone, is actually quite an exclusive space. And not everyone has access to it or sees themselves as having access to it.
Right.
Was that something that you felt prevented you from becoming a quote unquote an outdoorsy person and led to you being a late bloomer in that respect?
100%. Yeah, there's no question. And it's still something that I kind of battle with. Right now I have an 8-year-old daughter who feels very comfortable in the outdoors. And right now she's asking to go fishing. She's saying, "Mommy, I've never been fishing in my whole entire life. I really want to go fishing." And I'm thinking to myself, "Girl, I've never been fishing either. I don't even know where to start." And I've noticed that there's this imposter syndrome creeping up in me, right? Me, someone who, you know, is outside all the time for my career. I have been procrastinating taking my daughter fishing because I feel so uncomfortable accessing those spaces, right? I still feel like there's this kind of invisible barrier because I don't see a lot of representation. I don't see a lot of Black millennial moms taking their daughters fishing. I don't know where to get a fishing pole. I really don't. So there's even ways that me in my kind of empowered state still feel the echoes of society's barriers, you know, that they put up to show who belongs outside, who's welcome in the outdoors and who isn't. And if I were to rewind, when I was a little kid, I loved watching nature shows on TV. I just loved it. Like, nature documentaries were my jam.
Animals nearly always let you know if they're going to attack you. If you know enough, as I was saying, if you know enough about animals, you should be able to know when an elephant is going to charge. He will let you know. He will put out his ears. He will probably make a dummy charge. Now, if you're very silly, then you can persuade him to charge, and he could well kill you.
I liked Saturday morning cartoons, but if I probably had a choice, I would choose, like, nature shows. And, you know, I grew up in big cities, and I was under the impression that nature was really far away. I lived in San Francisco, and I could find the wilderness in Africa and South America and Asia. You had to cross oceans and continents, you know, to get to the wild. And I was also under the impression that, like, the people who have these adventures, who know the most, who can educate the world, and who are leaders in the environmental movement and environmental protection are, like, British and Australian middle-aged white guys. You know, I just thought, like, they've got it. Like, I've never seen a brown person, a female person, you know, like, on these shows. These guys have the best job. They're the smartest.
Going back to what you were saying about those white male wildlife hosts, you had the skill set and you had the chops and the intelligence and the curiosity, it sounds like, that's how you get to that job.
Thank you for saying that, for characterizing me that way, and people like me that way. I really believe that's true. You know, and I will just also add, Lale, that it was recently, it was literally this year, 2024, that a friend of mine challenged me to look up the bios of the nature show hosts that I loved so much when I was a kid, and some of the ones that I love to this day, to see what their education was and what their scientific background was. And when I tell you, like, not a master's degree, not a PhD, not a scientific research project on the books, you know, and this is something that I think women really go through a lot, is that in my quest to be a nature show host, to, like, be on par with these people, I went above and beyond with experience, with leadership, with academia, that's for sure. There is still this tremendous double standard when it comes to who has been very visible in this field and in this work and who is still fighting to be included. You know, in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm still on a fight, you know, to get to the places, mm-hmm. to the levels of success and influence that a lot of other people have had. And I realize, like, wait a second, I have all these degrees, I've led all these research projects, I've pushed and pulled and brought people with me, and I've asked for help, and I've, you know, like, had scary moments and all this stuff on this quest to just try to, like, be a leader in helping keep endangered species from extinction. You know, and my focus is on the plight of wild animals.
Focusing on those wild animals and this incredible study of them, you track them and you follow them when you're out in these extraordinary parts of the world.
One of the tools that I have used the most in my career is a tracking collar, right? So, like, whether it's a lion or a bear, it's a collar that goes around the animal's neck, kind of like what we use for our pets. And these days there are GPS devices that are attached to the collars. And the GPS device is essentially like the app we have on our smartphones that tells us, the little blue dot that tells us where we are on a map. And attaching these GPS collars to a lion's neck can allow us to track that animal every moment. So we have to capture the animal. We set a trap, which is usually just like a big cage, where we capture the animal and we'll sedate the animal, just immobilize it for half an hour, 45 minutes in order to give it a checkup, attach the collar, take a little hair sample, which gives us some DNA to understand how it's related to other lions on the landscape. And then we like get out of there. Even in wildlife conservation, data is just understanding the places that the lion frequents, the places in particular that the lion avoids on the landscape is really important in terms of how we protect the land that protects the lions. I've always been proud because my work has always very deliberately focused on females of the species, right? So whether it's bears or lions or primates, I'm looking at like, what is the female of reproductive age doing? Because if the females aren't protected, that means the cubs aren't protected, which means we do not have a healthy, growing, thriving population.
After the break, Dr. Ray's adventures in East Africa, including pursuing giraffe poachers and living with lions.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforest of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tires, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
I'm not even going to try and compare my own travel experience to yours, but there's sort of one occasion that I was on the Masai Mara, and it was so amazing to watch the dynamics of these animals and also to come up so close to them. And you start to see personalities and behavior coming through. What have been some of your up-close experiences?
I was 20 years old when I went to Kenya for the first time. And it wasn't just my first time being in Africa or East Africa. It was also my first time seeing a wild animal, taking a hike, pitching a tent, you know, having an outdoor experience.
What was it like seeing that wildlife for the first time?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you know, people go to Kenya to like go on these epic safaris and see, you know, all of these bucket list animal species. And I remember just traveling from the airport in Nairobi down to our campsite, which was in southern Kenya outside of Amboseli National Park. And we did not need to go on a safari. We did not need to enter a national park. I mean, just from the highway, I remember seeing, you know, a marabou stork was the very first animal that I saw, my very first wild animal ever in my life. And I remember thinking to myself, no one's ever told me about marabou stork. I thought I was going to see an elephant. But it from where I was in the car and where it was on the landscape, I mean, marabou storks can be 5 feet tall, right? I mean, they're these huge, huge birds. And it looked like a dinosaur. It looked like a velociraptor, right? Like walking around the landscape. And I remember thinking, like, talk about mysteries, right? I was like, no one told me about this. I'm already seeing something I didn't even expect. Like, what could be next? We would drive through national parks. I remember one of the first ways that my little group of students were trained was to like look at a group of wildebeest, say, at a distance, and to be able to estimate exactly how many. And then we'd drive and look at a group of zebras, and the challenge would be to estimate how many are there.
You have stories in the book about the ways in which the wildlife interact with the Maasai villages. And I mean, living on the Maasai means that lions are a part of your daily life. In the brief time I spent there, some of the people I met were telling me all sorts of stories. Could you share a story or two from your book about the wildlife that you encountered there?
I was living and working in central Tanzania, studying lions, right? One day I was with just one of the researchers who was a local Tanzanian guy, and he was from the Maasai community. So he had this really special relationship, you know, as a trained ecologist, but representing, you know, the people that were adjacent to the landscape. And one day we were together studying lions, and we got a call on the radio that poachers were afoot. And I freaked out. I thought poachers mean like machine guns and we better get out of here because I'm not trying to die today. And instead of leaving the bush, my colleague decided to go to where the poachers were. And I said, okay. And we drove, you know, off-road in our little vehicle to the site where the poachers were. And by the time we got there, the wildlife authorities had captured these men and they were handcuffed and they were looking very ashamed. They were seated. And next to them was a huge female giraffe, and she was dead. They had killed her. And she was lying down. And it was, I mean, even that moment has stuck with me for life. You know, giraffes are always upright. They're always standing. Their necks are so freaking long that they can't lie down, because if they did, they would never get back up. So they even sleep standing up. They give birth standing up. They kind of do everything standing up. So to see a giraffe on its side lying down was something that I had never seen and never expected to see. And it didn't look dead. You know, it looked very much alive, sleeping. I touched it and she felt warm. She was this big female giraffe, you know, over a ton in weight. And I, you know, and I cried, right? Like my whole world was wild animals. It was devastating to me. I was focused on her and the fact that her life had just been taken out by these, you know, selfish people. And what I noticed was that my colleague who I was with was talking to the poachers. And, you know, I looked over and I saw that these men were also crying, but for a different reason. They were crying because their lives were ruined in that moment, right? Like being captured and facing incarceration while they were just trying to like make money for their family. You know, they had nothing against giraffes. They just really needed some income. I noticed that Peter was having a moment with these guys. I don't know if he knew them or what, but that was happening. And I remember it kind of jarred me where I was like, wait a second, there's a lot of loss happening in this moment right now. there's a lot of pain for a lot of different people happening in this moment. And then the poachers got taken away. And I thought to myself, like, wow, what are we going to do? You know, here's this giraffe and, you know, maybe we could donate her body to science, or she could go to a museum, or, you know, or what is it going to be?
Here's a reading from that episode.
A giraffe can weigh thousands of pounds, and this one offered about a ton of muscle tissue. Peter, slightly gentler now with his delivery, explained that the amount of meat sitting in front of us could feed many people for a long time. But we had to act fast. Word had already spread throughout the neighboring Maasai communities, and people were on their way back with baskets, bags, and pots. Everyone would line up, hack off some giraffe meat with a machete, and bring it back to their home. We were in the bush, with no electricity and thus no refrigeration. All of this had to happen while the meat was still fresh and before nightfall, when carnivores would scavenge the carcass. Time was of the essence, and it was only safe for us to stay by the giraffe for a short time. While my mind had been racing with potential next steps moments before, this idea hadn't dawned on me. Of course there was an opportunity to use the whole animal. What, were we going to let it sit there and rot? Absolutely not. And of course this community of indigenous people who had shared the land with wildlife for millennia already had a protocol for when an animal is illegally killed. A glimmer of hope grew within me. I didn't have to be completely powerless in this tragic situation. I could be active in a solution. Optimism and action are parts of my core essence. And in that moment, I blossomed into the Ray who learns, understands, and helps.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
You know, in Swahili, I asked him, like, what's going on? What are we doing? And he explained, we don't have a lot of time. I was put to work and I was doing something with my body that I had literally been trained against, which is to like hack into the flesh of an animal that I'm like here on earth to protect. And we cut chunks of meat off of this giraffe and my hands were bloody and I smelled like, I mean, rank, right? And we're throwing just chunks of meat into the back of our truck until we couldn't anymore. And before we jumped in the truck to drive over to the villages, I saw in the distance, and you know, this is the central Tanzanian bush. It's very flat. And I could see this line of people. And I knew that they were women because I had become so close to the Maasai community in the red and deep purple cloaks that they wore with their dark brown bald heads and white beadwork. This line of women with bowls on their heads. Somehow they had heard that a giraffe went down and they are walking in a line to come collect meat also. And I have to stop myself every so often because I always want to cry. It was this moment where I realized that wildlife conservation and human need have to go hand in hand.
Coming up, studying bears around Lake Tahoe and the revelation of a 10-year secret.
when I was a graduate student and I was setting bear traps in order to catch them and put GPS collars on. I mean, it was so terrifying. I was by myself. This was the summer of 2012. And I was in such a remote part of the Western Nevada wilderness that, you know, there was no cell signal. There were no roads, even, like, not even unpaved dirt roads. So I was getting around mostly in an ATV, right? In an off-road little buggy, setting a bear trap. And when I got up to, you know, this high ridge to put more bait in the trap, there was no bear there. It was hot. I was sweaty. I was alone, you know, for like on day 10. You know, I kept thinking to myself, like, why did I think science was cool? This is awful. You know, so I was in a bad mood.
You're like, I did this to myself.
Yeah, like, this is optional. Like, I could be a crossing guard. What am I doing? And I, you know, I had a backpack full of bear spray, you know, a flare gun, my water, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I just left it at my ATV because it would weigh me down on my little hike up to the bear trap. And I was just in such a frustrated mood, right? And so I hiked up. I saw that the trap had not caught a bear. The bait was gone. I thought, you know, some little rascal animal has eaten the can of tuna fish that I left here. So, you know, I set another can of tuna fish in there and probably cursing to myself. And I stand up quickly, turn around, and right in front of me is a big 600-pound male black bear. And what you're supposed to do when you see a bear is, you know, one, spray your bear spray, which I didn't have. And two, just begin to back away slowly. You can speak in a loud voice to kind of frighten the bear a little bit, but you're always backing away slowly. Honey, all of my training left my body in that moment, and I turned and ran, which is the exact opposite thing you're supposed to do. And the bear naturally started chasing me.
Oh my God.
Which is what they do if you run, right? Prey run, right? If you're a rabbit, if you're a little deer, you run away and the bear catches you and eats you. That's what prey do. And I just, it's like something overtook me. I lost my mind and ran. And I was stumbling and I was falling again. There's no trail, right? I'm just like here in this arid environment. I could hear the bear right behind me. I could hear its breath. I felt like I could feel it nipping at my back. I don't know if that's real or not, but that's what I remember. And to be clear, you know, bears can run 25 miles an hour, right? Humans cannot outrun a bear. I can run, you know, 4 miles an hour, you know? So the fact that it did not touch me, bite me, attack me, kill me, is completely because the bear really just wanted that can of tuna fish and wanted to scare me off of it. And once I got started, you know, running away, it thought to itself like, oh, great, she's gone. That was annoying. And
I've got another can of that delicious tuna.
Yeah, let me go eat.
My evil plan all along.
And I kept this story a secret. I mean, I ran back to my ATV. I buzzed back to my campsite. I remember crying for hours. First of all, scared. I was mad at myself for making such a horrible mistake. I was also scared to go back to that place. And I was afraid to tell the biologist that I was working with, right? Who like had trained me and entrusted me and were depending on me. I was mortified. And I ended up keeping this whole story a secret until I wrote this book. So over 10 years, I never told anyone. And then I wrote this book and decided like, you know what? I am super imperfect in all kinds of ways, not just in, you know, my field biology. But I felt like I was ready to talk about the things that I've really screwed up and the things that I got right.
Usually when you screw up, you do tend to learn from it and hopefully maybe don't make the same mistake again. I imagine you've come up against a couple of other dicey situations, perhaps not quite so near death, but I can't imagine that that is the one and only time that you've been scared in your job. Has there been an occasion where you've looked back and realized now that you've learned how to manage that fear and to be able to make a clear-headed decision in how you respond to it?
Yes. Yes. Something that traveling and living in the outdoors so much with wild animals has taught me is that most of the time I'm actually safer in nature than when I'm not. You know, I have family members and friends who are very much not outdoorsy. And so I often get people asking me like, aren't you scared? Aren't you scared? You're dealing with lions, you're dealing with bears, you're dealing with, you know, sharks sometimes, you know. And I often say to myself, like, I don't think I'm in more danger than if I'm just walking down the streets. I mean, you know, the United States has a gun violence crisis. You know, if I were a firefighter, I think my job would put me in more danger than what I do. So in a lot of ways, I say that to people, but I also say it to myself. You know, I also remind myself that when I'm camping and there's a lion circling my tent, you know, trying to figure out what's inside, that more likely than not, I'm going to be okay. But there is human on human violence, violence against women. You know, something that I've literally experienced and learned in real life is how often nature protects me and how often nature is a safe haven for me and for so many people.
I've gone to some pretty far away, isolated places, sometimes on my own. And people ask me, have you felt scared? Are you worried about someone attacking you? And I think, I live in New York.
Yeah.
A woman got attacked in my subway station weeks before I flew to the Amazon.
Yeah.
You met some hunters in Nevada?
Oh my gosh. I was living in Nevada in this rural community with a cultural group of white mountain-dwelling Nevadans that was very different at the time. I was living in Harlem, New York. And, you know, I had been there for months and everyone was so friendly and so inviting, you know, and really pulled me into the community right away. What I thought was fascinating was that a lot of the folks who were in the wildlife conservation and management world were also hunters. They'd hunt elk, they'd hunt deer, you know, they'd hunt all kinds of things. Bear hunting was legal, but they wouldn't hunt bears. And so we ate a lot of game meat, right? I'd be invited for dinner. I don't hunt. That's not my thing. I've never done it. I have no interest. But I opened my mind. My mind was expanded and I would eat what they would serve. And one day I was served something that was particularly delicious and I did not know what it was. And I watched my colleagues look at me and like elbow each other, you know? And finally I was like, what am I eating? What is this? And I was told it was mountain lion, that we were eating mountain lion chops with a mushroom gravy. And I probably stopped mid-chew. And, you know, and I had to kind of like backtrack in my mind, like, is it legal to hunt mountain lions? Is this, you know, was this poaching?
A real internal monologue going on.
Yeah, yeah. It was not poaching this time. It was someone's wife had gotten a mountain lion tag and had done what is almost impossible, which was to like hunt a mountain lion. And we were eating it. I am against mountain lion hunting. I really don't like that idea. I don't. I think that if I had known about it before, I would have declined the meal. I'm not really okay with it, but it happened and the world kept turning and I learned and it was a cultural moment that overlapped with my wildlife conservation like work and career. You know, I to this day, I lead a mountain lion conservation project here in Central California. And so my job is to like protect mountain lions and keep them from getting killed. And I am a person who has eaten one before.
Thank you for sharing so many brilliant stories. I was gripped, particularly by the bear. I was thinking a lot about what you said about how even now you've actually only been to a handful of national parks, even though you've gone just so many extraordinary places. What's your advice to people who don't see themselves in the outdoors or represented in the outdoors to start just stepping out there and experiencing it?
My advice is you can ease yourself in or you can enter at whatever entry point feels comfortable and safe and accessible to you. I'm a big fan of America's national parks and national parks of the world. I'm a huge fan. I recently learned that the American national parks have a free entry day once or twice a year, so you don't even have to pay. I think it's soon. I think it usually aligns with Earth Month. But there are days that you can go for free. And that's beautiful, right? That's our tax dollars at work. That's how it should be. So I'm a big fan of those. But I don't think that people necessarily have to climb the highest mountain, camp with lions, you know, go to the furthest, most wilderness intense places to be outside. I think that watching a butterfly from your window or breathing fresh air or watching your favorite nature documentary counts just as much as doing something extreme and physical.
I think that is a perfect note to wrap up on. Next week, award-winning photojournalists who've documented experiences in Gaza, Ukraine, Egypt, and Yemen. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hanna. Our engineers are Jake Loomis, Nick Pittman, and James Yost. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. See you next week.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Rina Ninen, the host of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Over the past few years, we've looked at how women around the world are changing societal norms to increase their economic power. This season, we're focusing completely on girls, how they're pushing for a brighter, more powerful future, and what the rest of us can do to set them up for success. Join us for stories about girl power, young women who are fighting for change, to give themselves a chance to live a life of their own choosing. That's season 6 of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
From PRX.